This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Bobby, and I'm your friend who knows just a little bit too much about pop culture. Welcome to your weekly meeting of Pop Culture Fanatics Anonymous. Picture this. You're 4 or 5 years old, and you're getting up for school. You rushed and got ready in record time. Your parents have finally let you start dressing yourselves, and you put together a questionable at best outfit, but you're dressed nonetheless. You rush downstairs and plop yourself down right in front of the television so that you can catch just a little bit of your favorite preschool TV show before you head off to school. Think about what that show was for you. Maybe you were a Nick Jr. kid, so you were frequenting the Dora the Explorers or Blue's Clues of the world. Or perhaps you were a Playhouse Disney or Disney Jr. for the younger listeners out there kid, and you were a fan of shows like PB&J Otter or Little Out of the Box. Or you probably headed on down to a little street called Sesame to hang out with your favorite furry friends. No matter the station, no matter the show, we can all recall those foundational shows that we loved and learned from when we were small. The brilliance of those shows were their ability to be able to infuse research and create curriculum for these shows that millions of children around the world would see. If you were to ask me, and you technically are because you're listening to my podcast, but if you were to ask me, children's educational programming not only readies kids for school through teaching them their ABCs and 1-2-3s, but they are also pretty paramount in teaching children the basics of intangible skills, like dealing with their emotions or even things like media literacy. For the next few weeks, we're going to be taking a deep dive into how some of our favorite preschool shows came to be and take a little peek into the science that goes into creating them. So, grab a snack, get a juice box, and sit crisscross applesauce because we're going back to preschool. So if that sounds good to you, let's get started. So our journey begins with perhaps the most famous examples of children's educational programming, with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and Sesame Street premiering in 1968 and 1969 respectively. Allow me to set the scene for you of what programming looked like on television around this time. Consider the 50s and 60s as the infancy and teenage years of television. Consider the 50s and 60s as the infancy and childhood years of television. The medium was relatively new still, and that means that many formats that feel normal and commonplace to us now, like the sitcom, were burgeoning into the media landscape for the very first time. This also means that programming was not as robust in development and production, and much of television was treated almost exclusively as a means of advertising. It still is, but even more so back then. Like with company-sponsored programming, for example. It's why soap operas are called soap operas. It's because the programming was sponsored slash presented by soap companies. You learn something new every day. For children's entertainment, the landscape was a little bit more vast than one might think at the time. You had shows like Leave It to Beaver, Tom and Jerry, Captain Kangaroo, and the Mickey Mouse Club that were all on air at a certain point. Television was doing a really good job of entertaining children and selling to children, but there was some really untapped potential there. The undoubted king of children's educational programming is a man that we all know. You could call him a neighbor. That's right, it's Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers is a figure of children's educational programming that we've known since kind of forever. It's felt like forever, but it's really since the late 60s. And hundreds of thousands of millions of kids have been able to interact with Mr. Rogers and learn things about their emotions and really stretch the bounds of their imagination with his shows. But Mr. Rogers was kind of in the children's media landscape space since the early 50s, which sounds kind of strange because Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood didn't premiere until 1968, like I mentioned. However, the first instance, or perhaps prototype, of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood premiered in 1953 on a show called The Children's Corner. The Children's Corner was kind of birthed out of Fred Rogers, who had just begun his television career at NBC, and he was also within the founding organization of America's first community-supported television station, which was WQED out of Pittsburgh. And he was the program director, and he was in charge of scheduling. And he was tasked with scheduling a children's program. And so he reached out far and wide to see who could produce such a program. And when no one did it, he decided to step up himself and do it. So Rogers decided to step up, and it was in April of 1954 that The Children's Corner was released. So he did this in collaboration with one of the hosts of the show, which was Josie Carey. And both of them would write the scripts and they would do the music. And kids really, really loved it. So much so that in 1955, they won a Sylvania Award for the best locally produced children's program in the country. The Children's Corner is, like I said, it's very much kind of a prototype of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in that it involved puppets. And this was where we get our first instance of King Friday and Daniel Tiger and X the Owl. So these characters showed up first in the Children's Corner and then were carried over to his other programs. So in the early 60s, Rogers had moved to Toronto, Ontario, Canada, or Toronto, and he had a new series that was based off of Children's Corner, and it was called Mr. Rogers, which was all one word, and it was only 15 minutes, and it was on CBC television. Again, a similar vein of the Children's Corner, which involved the puppets, it involved Mr. Rogers talking to kids directly, you know, kind of validating their feelings, teaching them about their emotions, stretching the bounds of their imagination, everything, all like that. And then finally, in 1966, he got the rights to his program, Mr. Rogers, that was playing on CBC in Canada, and he brought it back to the US, back to QED, or WQED in Pittsburgh. And this is where we get, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And this was the iteration of the show that we're perhaps all, you know, the most familiar with. So the show ran from February 19th, 1968, all the way to August 31st, 2001. And the final episode was taped on December 1st, 2000. But it wasn't released until 2001. And this show is something that is truly so special to me, and I think it's special to really everyone, but this is not necessarily a show that he set out with a strict curriculum of this is what we're going to talk about, and you know, these are the different kind of benchmarks that we want to hit. Like, it was the first show that I think touched on the point that I talked about in the intro, which was teaching kids intangible skills like their emotions, about using their imagination, like these things that are definitely baked into every, I would say, children's educational programming, you know, series worth its weight. They teach those things, but it really kind of got started with Mr. Rogers. So a core tenet of his programming and a lot of his approach to how he would do things on his shows is to treat children like adults, and that treating their emotions as real and valid and teaching them how to handle those things, which seems like commonplace, but it's very often that like a child's emotions can be like, you know, waved off as, oh, you're just being dramatic, or that's not really happening, because they are, you know, they're itty bitty and they're just now getting to understand the world around them. But Mr. Rogers really wanted to hone in on the fact that children's emotions are very valid, and the best way to handle them is to handle them and not to avoid them. So like I said, Mr. Rogers didn't stick to like the strictest of curriculums and, you know, had all of this research baked into how the show would function. that wouldn't come until another show that was in production around the same time, which is, of course, Sesame Street. I've talked about Sesame Street a ton on this show in 1,001 capacities, and we're going to do 1,002 this week. But Sesame Street, as you guys know, just to give a brief wraparound for anyone who is needing a little bit of a refresher on Sesame Street, the show kind of began towards the end of the late 60s when there was a lot of social unrest and there was a lot of things happening within the country. And I think a lot of people were beginning to think, okay, we have a lot of social unrest. We have a lot of just social issues that are happening right now. We have this kind of emerging art form, media form in television, and there's a potential here to use television to help reach some people who may be directly impacted by these social changes that are happening. And so that's essentially kind of how Sesame Street, how it came to be. So in the late 60s, a woman by the name of Joan Ganz Cooney, she saw that there was potential for television to teach kids just as much as it entertained them or sold things to them. So she produced a preschool program out of Harlem, and it kind of led her to understanding the things that were happening within the civil rights movement. She was dealing directly with Black children, and she was seeing that there was a really large deficit between how ready Black children were for school in opposition to their white counterparts. And so she then collaborated with a longtime friend of hers, by a man by the name of Lloyd Morissette, who was a psychologist and a Carnegie Corporation executive. So the two collaborated together and created the production company that would then go on to produce Sesame Street, aka Children's Television Network, which is still around today. And they would go on to create Sesame Street. A key player in this also is a man by the name of John Stone, who served as the director and writer on a lot of early Sesame Street episodes. So you have the three of them, and then they bring in this young upstart named Jim Henson and his new Muppet creations that are taking the late night world by storm. Because if you don't know, the Muppets kind of began in the more adult space. They would be seen largely on programming like The Tonight Show and everything like that. But as I mentioned with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, puppets were a really big thing for children's programming. I mean, children love puppets, so it makes sense. But they saw how different these versions of puppets were with Henson's Muppets. And so he's like, okay, let's bring that in. I think there's something here. So you have Joan Ganz Cooney, you have Lloyd Morissette, you have John Stone, you have Jim Henson, you have a man by the name of Joe Raposo, who comes in and does a lot of the music for Sesame Street. He was the mind behind songs like It Ain't Easy Being Green and C is for Cookie. So all of these things, all these people are kind of conspiring together to create this really, really amazing show. On top of that, you also have a team of mainly Black women who are the masterminds behind the curriculum of Sesame Street. Because Sesame Street was one of the first and one of the most prominent examples of the melding of curriculum and of production, pretty much. So this is a quote from a Smithsonian Magazine article on the kind of hidden roots, Black roots of Sesame Street, saying, quote, a January 1970 Ebony profile of Sesame Street included a photo of Cooney flanked by a team of African-American women, including the head of Seattle Head Start and the headmistress of a New York preschool. Chester Pierce, an African-American psychiatrist and Harvard professor, helped design what he called the show's hidden curriculum to build up the self-worth of Black children through the presentation of positive Black images. Pierce also insists that the show present an integrated, harmonious community to challenge the marginalization of African-Americans that children routinely saw on television and elsewhere in society. A lot of things were happening at once, kind of behind the scenes with Sesame Street. They were creating a curriculum based on research, so they would go and they would talk to children. They would ask them what holds your attention. They would show them things. They would show them segments that involved, you know, children with the Muppets. They would show them segments that just involved the Muppets. They would show them segments that just involved children to see what would resonate and what was holding their attention. So you have that working. You have the physical production of the show, which is how do we make a show with Muppets and puppet characters and children, human children and human adults, all kind of able to live, who are able to live in this community for the show. So you have all of these different pieces working together, and they somehow pulled it off. Like, Sesame Street really, really was a feat. And at the time, it seems so commonplace now. And obviously, you would obviously have a show like Sesame Street. But there was a lot of contention when it premiered in the late 60s, early 70s. So obviously, like I mentioned, a ton of social unrest. And even though things were beginning to be integrated by law, there was still an incredible line of demarcation, if you will, between certain groups. Like, it was, things were still massively segregated. And when Sesame Street was shown in the South, there was actually a large push to have it banned because it decided to show a racially diverse cast. It decided to show Black children. So much so that in 1970, the state of Mississippi banned the series for having a racially diverse cast, which eventually that ban was lifted, but it still happened. So, like, Sesame Street, we don't think of it as this political show, but it kind of was at the time. So it's this massive feat of production. It's this massive feat of research. And Children's Television Workshop has definitely been kind of on the cutting edge of, and one of the largest providers of, a lot of research around children's programming and how kids watch TV, certain patterns associated with it, and ultimately providing a lot of research to help more people create more shows that will resonate with children and help to teach them things. I obviously, as I've mentioned many times on this show, in certain capacities, I think Sesame Street is probably the most important show in the history of television. I mean, mostly everyone under the sun, not just in the U.S., even though this episode is mostly talking about, you know, U.S. shows. Mostly everyone under the sun, like on the planet, has grown up with Sesame Street to a certain degree, and they've learned a thing or two from the show. And I think the show has an obligation and a duty to advocate for its audience, and it's done that since the beginning. So we talked about two shows from the late 60s that have run basically for the most of most people on this planet Earth right now's life. So now we take a little bit of a jump to the 90s. The 90s was a really good time for children's programming, China as a whole. By this time, we had dedicated networks just to children's programming, which was kind of insane to think of when we're talking about what television was in the 50s and 60s. Like, having a dedicated channel that only played content for kids was a relatively new advent, because most shows intended for kids would, like, play in a certain block on a dedicated channel, like an ABC, an NBC, a Fox, etc. But by the 90s, we had dedicated networks like Nickelodeon. And with that, Nickelodeon was really kind of, I would say, a big leader in children's programming and just, like, programming intended for kids. If you were a child of the 90s, you definitely know Nickelodeon took the, like, by kids for kids approach, right? And so with that, they had the main network that played, you know, like Doug and Hey Arnold and Rugrats and shows like that. But they then began to branch into preschool programming with Nick Jr. So within Nick Jr., you have shows like Dora the Explorer and a show that I love that I hold very dear to my heart, which is Blue's Clues. And Blue's Clues was kind of the impetus for this episode, if you will. Blue's Clues was one of those shows that I think we don't really understand the impact of off-rip. Like, it's on the level of a Sesame Street to me as far as impact on the back end with production and with the curriculum of it all. But it seems like this very simple show kind of in front of you. There's a guy, he has a dog named Blue, and they sing songs and they, like, you know, solve a problem within the duration of the episode via these clues that Blue leaves with her paw prints. And they, like, have friends like Mr. Salt and Mrs. Pepper and the clock and everything, and they, like, have a song for mail time. Like, it seems like a very, very, very simple show. But the back end of it is really, really interesting. So we're going to go into it, obviously. So we're jumping forward in time to around the mid-90s. The show about a cute little blue dog and her rotating caravan of human companions was built solely off of extensive research into how kids think. Show creators Angela Santomero, Todd Kessler, and Tracy Page Johnson partnered with child psychologists to find the best ways for kids to retain the things that they were being taught. Most preschool age shows focus heavily on rote learning, or that was how well kids could recall information given to them. Whereas the Blue's Clues team decided to focus on mastery, or how well kids could understand and apply what they were being taught. And the main way that they did this was through both repetition and audience participation. With repetition, each episode functioned like a storybook, so the camera would literally move from left to right as if you were reading a story from start to finish. And each episode followed this exact same structure, so kids could get used to it. And then with audience participation, or the call and response element of it, the show gave audiences enough time to solve the problem without getting bored, and had kid voiceovers that gave the correct answers, which would encourage the kids watching to want to participate. And it was actually funny when I mentioned the piece about the repetition aspect of it. When Blue's Clues premiered, they literally would play the same episode every day for, like, you know, 5 days or whatever it was. It would be the same episode at the same time playing for every single day. And this led to parents calling Nickelodeon and being like, hey, something's wrong with your network. You just keep playing the same episode of Blue's Clues every single day. It's not a new episode. And they had to tell parents, like, hey, yeah, nothing's wrong. That's on purpose. It's so that kids could watch the episode and basically have it repeated to them every single day, these elements that they were learning within the episode. And so that's what the focus of mastery versus rote. Because rote would be as if they played one new episode for each day of the week, and it would just kind of be like kids would be able to take it in, but they may not be able to fully tell you what they saw. They may only be able to recall a few things, but with the approach of repeating the episode again and again and again, the elements that they're supposed to catch, like the, you know, curriculum that's baked into the episode, sticks a lot more than it would if they did it the kind of traditional route. I think I told this story on a previous episode. I think, funnily enough, I think it was the Grinch episode from this past holiday season. But Blue's Clues kind of had the whole, not underdog thing, no pun intended, but it kind of had the approach of Nickelodeon, or Nick Jr., was excited for the show, and obviously because they were going to air it, but a lot of their focus as a studio and as a network was going to the Wubbulous World of Dr. Seuss, which was this puppet show that featured Dr. Seuss characters, obviously. So that was in production around the same time as Blue's Clues, and so a lot of the network attention was going there because it was this big IP. Kids love Dr. Seuss and they love the characters. They're like reading the books in school, so there's going to be a really, like, great, you know, crossover there, and they were just super excited about it. And so that kind of allowed for the Blue's Clues team, like, they were still getting, you know, network support, but they were able to kind of do their own thing a little bit and do things that were a little bit unconventional. Like I mentioned, the repetition thing was definitely super unconventional for children's programming at the time. And I think also their approach to music was really unconventional too. So if you remember, Blue's Clues, is the score for it is jazz. It's based in jazz. I think a lot of children's programming, especially for like a preschool market, likes to use the same type of sounds, which is very like wild and crazy and upbeat, because it's, you know, it's kids. But to kind of use jazz, which is a very, you know, mellow, very chill kind of vibe, I think it helps to further relay the very cozy atmosphere of Blue's Clues. And it probably exposed a lot of kids to jazz, honestly. Like, I'm sure, like, there are some people who are like, yeah, I heard jazz for the first time on on Blue's Clues, and then I just listened to it more and more, and I really liked it. And I think that that approach is not uncanny. Like, it's not something that wouldn't make sense for the time. So, like I said, Blue's Clues was one of those shows that I think the impact of it, we don't readily acknowledge or like readily think of when we think of like major kids educational programming pillars. Like, we obviously think of like Sesame Street and the like, but Blue's Clues is just one of those shows that is, it stuck with me so much more than I thought it would, especially in my adulthood, now officially in my mid-20s. Like, it's a show that I would easily point to, and if I had kids, I would definitely like show them the old episodes of Blue's Clues. But Blue's Clues is also a great example of kind of legacy media within this very specific genre of children's educational programming, because there is a new iteration of Blue's Clues with Blue's Clues and You, which stars a new human companion to Blue. His name is Josh, and they have brought Blue into the the kind of tech-laden landscape of television. And so, like, instead of a physical handy-dandy notebook that Steve had in the original series, Josh has a handy-dandy notebook that's essentially like an iPhone, which is really cool to see, because most kids, you know, want to be able to look at and identify things that they already kind of know in their waking life. They want to be able to identify things that they already see in their real life, and so having a notebook versus a phone probably is a switch that makes a little bit more sense. But the show is really, really good. I've looked at it, not just for research, but also, you know, it's a good show. I don't know, I'm not gonna knock the show just because I'm 24, come on. But also, they just came out with a movie this past year, which was Blue's Big City Adventure, and I'm going to be so real with you guys. I had a blast watching that movie. I had an absolute blast watching that movie. Not only were there great songs and dance numbers, like, Blue is a little dancer, let me tell you, but it was just so fun. And honestly, I don't think that it was just for kids. Like, sure, was every preschooler excited for that movie? Yeah. But it was really every preschooler and Bobby. We were excited. We were excited as a collective. And the reason why I think it wasn't just for preschoolers is the inclusion of Steve and Joe from the original series. Those scenes were so egregiously just for the probably parents now who have kids who were watching that movie, or just like me with no kids and just, you know, just really loves Blue. That's what that movie was for. It was for me and every other preschooler. So I'm never going to knock Blue. That's my girl. But yeah, Blue's Clues, an amazing show, and a show that I love quite dearly. Many of these shows that I'm going to mention have Peabody's, like the Peabody Awards. Sesame Street has a Peabody, pretty sure. Yeah, Mr. Rogers has a Peabody, and Blue's Clues also has a Peabody Award. I think literally everyone, maybe minus one, might not have a Peabody Award. But Peabody's tend to honor excellence in children's educational programming. So if you're a young parent and you're wondering, hey, what's kind of the best of the best of children's programming that's like both good and also, you know, it's going to teach my kid and I don't have to fear them watching, you know, Cocomelon for 3 hours or whatever it is, check out the Peabody Awards just to see what children's programming has won, because that's always a good marker. That is a shameless plug, because I used to work at the Peabody Awards, and so I saw a lot of entries and entrants come in, and I, like, more than the average person, a weird database of what has won a Peabody and what has not. But yeah, always a good place to start for that. So moving on, we're going to stay within the Nick Jr. landscape. So moving into the 2000s, we have another show that is, again, it's similar to Blue's Clues in that it's not a, like, overtly, like, you know, top of the heap children's educational program. But once you, like, remember it, you're like, oh, yeah, that really was good. And it had a little bit of a resurgence, I would say, on TikTok probably a year or two ago, which is The Backyardigans. This was a show that I quite enjoyed. It was a little bit on the tail end of when I would have been watching it. It was probably right around the time that I would have been watching it. So the series follows the adventures of Pablo, Tyrone, Uniqua, Tasha, and Austin. And they're a group of imaginative kids who go on these amazing adventures without ever leaving their backyards, hence the name The Backyardigans. The show premiered in 2004 and was described as a, quote, homegrown Nick Jr. property, as it was made by creators who had been with Nick Jr. for years, one of which was the creator of the series, Janice Burgess, and we have to talk about her. Burgess joined Nickelodeon in 1995 as an executive in charge of production for shows like Little Bill and Blue's Clues. However, this was not her first rodeo with preschool programming, as she had worked at Sesame Workshop before coming to Nickelodeon. One of the most interesting facts about the series is that the concept for it began as a live-action series called Me and My Friends, and this version featured only Pablo, Tyrone, Tasha, and Uniqua, so there was no Austin, who were friends with a trio of meerkats, who were called the Meerkats. And this was not picked up by Nickelodeon, but it's a really popular piece of lost media. If you're familiar with like the genre of media that is lost media, it's a very popular phenomena. So definitely do a little bit of a deep dive into that if you're interested. So Burgess took the idea and she repitched it as an animated series. And that's how The Backyardigans as we know it was born. So each episode of the show is kind of a romp into a different world. And for many of the episodes, the way that they explore that is through music. I think the biggest and most memorable piece of The Backyardigans is how insanely good the music is. Because I think the song that was trending amongst a few of them was Castaways, which is this like kind of a bossa nova style song that they did for this children's show. It was really, really great. And also with the music, the characters dance too. So the series employed the former director of the children's program at Alvin Ailey School, Beth Bogus, who choreographed all the dances and actually got kid performers to perform them. So from there, the footage of the dances being performed would be sent to the animators, and then those movements would be replicated onto the character. So if you're kind of familiar with, you know, like rotoscoping, it's kind of like that, but not directly on top, I don't think. It's not like they just trace the movements of the kids that were dancing. They would just take the movements and then map it onto the characters. So the worlds that the group was able to imagine truly had no bounds, and that was all definitely by design. So Janice Burgess has stated that she was inspired by films like Die Hard and Terminator 2 for their endless adventure to want to create a world for kids that was just as boundless and fantastical, and I absolutely think she nailed it. The Backyardigans, again, is one of those shows that I would absolutely show a child now, and I think they would really enjoy it. And it definitely carried over a lot of the core foundational research aspects from shows like Little Bill and Blue's Clues. That the research that those shows had done, specifically Blue's Clues, I think many Nick Jr. shows were able to replicate success in their own ways from, because they just really understood kids and understood how kids watch television. And I think that's the dance with children's educational programming. Kids are very much a part of the process. Like, it's not just, I think a kid will like this, so let's just make a show about this. You know, like, there's so much that goes into it, and kids are a necessary part. And so many of these shows, from what I've read and from what I've watched, so many of the people behind these shows are like, yeah, you have to talk to kids and like get inside their heads and see like what is it that they like, what holds their attention, what doesn't hold their attention. And sometimes it's things that you just might not think are going to be kind of at the forefront of a child's mind. And so that's what goes into making these shows as good as they are. Like, some of them are just like, the research piece aside, a lot of these shows are just good shows. Like, just good, solid pieces of media for kids. And that's what I mean by a lot of these shows building media literacy. Because with a show, for example, like The Backyardigans, where they're going on all these fantastical adventures and everything within the bounds of their backyard, they're introducing kids to different like tropes and visual references to other things that they're kind of building a repertoire like in their mind of like, oh, I remember that from The Backyardigans, and seeing how it applies. So like, it just makes sense that this genre of programming is kind of the first stop on your media literacy adventure, I would say, like as you get older and start to watch more things. So as we wrap up, we're going to talk about one final show, which is a relatively new show, I would say, in that I did not watch it because I was a grown adult when it came on, but that does not stop me from watching it now, and that is Bluey. Everybody, I think, with a child under the age of 5 on the planet knows what Bluey is and can tell you a little bit of something about the show. Bluey is everywhere. And following in the footsteps of her American cousin, Blue, from Blue's Clues, Bluey is a little cute little blue dog who the show is kind of this, could be described as kind of a slice of life style show. So for some of these shows that I've mentioned, like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and Sesame Street and Blue's Clues, they're speaking directly to kids for the most part, or they have elements of the show that talk directly to children. They like break the fourth wall. But with shows like Bluey, it's almost like a sitcom for kids, pretty much. Like, that's what the foundation of Bluey is. So if you don't know, and if you haven't seen the show, especially if you were an adult, the show isn't actually an Australian show. And so all the characters have an Australian accent because it's produced in Australia. And it's, I think that adds a certain funness to it, especially for Western audiences and especially for kids who may not have a lot of who don't have a ton of familiarity with different accents and everything. I think shows from different corners of the world being able to kind of be used in different countries, and like programs that are native to one country kind of being culturally exported to others, is always going to be a great time. And I think this show is a really great example of that. I know that Disney Junior has been kind of not on the cutting edge, but like they have been a really strong proponent of bringing in and syndicating children's educational programming for Disney Junior from other countries. So Australia, this is one. The BBC, so a lot of like UK programming makes its way over to the US, as well as a lot of Canadian programming, because animation, especially children's animation, has a pretty rich and illustrious history within Canada, as I mentioned at the top of the episode with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. But the concept of Bluey kind of began very, not simply, but kind of simply. It was a co-commission between the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, or ABC, and the British Broadcasting Corporation, or the BBC, and they co-commissioned an animated series for preschool children. And it was going to be developed by the Queensland production company Ludo Studio. And so they just wanted to make this show. And so they received the funding, and it was created by Joe Brum. And in the show is actually inspired by his raising of his own two daughters. So he has daughters that are around the same age as the lead children of the series. So Bluey, who is the namesake of the show, and Bingo, which is her little sister, and he has children around the same age. And so a lot of people who have worked on the show have said that basically this series is kind of like, it looks kind of autobiographical, because it talks about just, you know, like all of the characters feel very native to Brum's family. And he even has some of his family members in the show themselves. I think his mom plays the grandma in the show. So it's like a very homegrown production of it. And so Joe Brum had worked on children's programs in the UK as a freelance animator, and he decided to create Bluey as this kind of counterpart or copy of or like replica of Peppa Pig, but just for an Australian audience. And Peppa Pig definitely has the same vibe too, with the whole kind of slice of life sitcom-y feel for a preschool audience. And so there's not a set, you know, like they're going to teach ABCs or 1-2-3s in this series, but it is very much taking the kind of Mr. Rogers approach of teaching intangible skills. And a lot of the show that I've seen like touches on even like very adult topics. So there's one episode where Bluey's mom's sister, so Bluey's aunt, comes to visit, and she has been kind of hesitant to come and visit her sister and her sister's kids because she can't have kids of her own. And so they explore that aspect of, which is a very adult concept, of not being able to have your own children. They explore that within the realm of this show, which is kind of blew my mind when I saw it for the first time. And I think that's what really pulled me into the show. The show also is very, perhaps most famous for showing a very positive depiction of fatherhood with Bluey's dad, Bandit. And I definitely would agree that the show does a really, really great job of showing this very lovely but also very like fun family dynamic within the Bluey household. So yeah, the show is, it does a really good job of depicting a lot of difficult concepts. It does a really great job of depicting very realistic but also very positive versions of, you know, different like family dynamics. So the show is, like all the shows that I've mentioned, is also built on research to a certain degree. And it is focusing heavily on socio-dramatic play, which we don't tend to talk about all that often as far as the aspect of research. Like usually it's just like, hey, what's going to hold a child's attention? But socio-dramatic play is just a focus on play as a concept. So at this time, a lot of children are like playing is not something that they're taught. They just kind of do it. And so sociodramatic play is quoted as being rooted in the child's real life experiences. And so it tends to fall into three different categories, which is family scenes. So playing house with assigned, you know, like familial roles like the mom and the dad. Character scenes, so being a superhero or being a princess, and functional scenes, so like playing doctor. And that's what sociodramatic play is. And so a lot of episodes of Bluey is Bingo and Bluey engaging in sociodramatic play. And the creator, Joe Brum, has brought up that a lot of that was based off of just watching his own kids play. And he said that it was just as natural. He was quoted as saying that it was as natural as breathing to them. Like they just kind of did it. They didn't have to be taught it. They didn't learn it from anywhere. They just did it. And there was this really imaginative aspect to it. And so that's where a lot of the stories for the different episodes come to be. But Bluey, I think, has quickly taken over everything. Like I think a lot of kids watch it. And as funny as it is, a lot of just as many children watch it are like depressed 20-year-olds are also watching it. Like Bluey is for them, but Bluey is also for us. You know what I mean? Like it's just one of those shows that like I could see myself sitting down and watching with like a 5-year-old, and we would both be just as engaged in it. Like I would treat it like I am watching any other show. Like for adults, that's how I treat watching Bluey. So that brings us to the end of this episode. And while I could try and wax poetic about the importance of early childhood programming, and you could probably imagine that I could do that. And I think you know how passionate I am about this subject based on just the sheer length of this episode. But I think I'm going to let an old friend end this episode for me.
You know, it happens so often. I walk down the street and someone 20 or 30 or 40 years old will come up to me and say, "You are Mr. Rogers, aren't you?" And then they tell me about growing up with the neighborhood and how they're passing on to the children they know what they found to be important in our television work. Like expressing their feelings through music and art and dance and sports and drama and computers and writing, and invariably we end our little time together with a hug. I'm just so proud of all of you who have grown up with us, and I know how tough it is some days to look with hope and confidence on the months and years ahead. But I would like to tell you what I often told you when you were much younger. I like you just the way you are. It's such a good feeling to know that we're lifelong friends.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode, Afternooners. If you don't know, the Afternooners is my name for all of us. So if you made it to the end of this episode, congratulations, you're an Afternooner now. If you like this episode, don't forget to rate and review this podcast. If you had a great time and helps out the pod, you get to tell me how you're feeling about the pod, and I get that sweet hit of praise and validation that is my life force and keeps me going. If you want to know where else to find me on the internet, you can find me at The Afternoon Special on TikTok or over on Twitter at Hi, I'm Bobby, HIIMBOBBI. And if you're thinking, Bobby, I need to go watch Bluey. You've convinced me. I think it might be my new favorite show. I need to go do that. Bestie, I fully support that decision and trust and believe as soon as I click done on this recording, I will be turning on Bluey for myself. So, I put all that information in the description box just for you. You're welcome. I spent a little bit of time researching for this episode, as you could probably tell. And so that means I'm listening to a lot of music and listening to a lot of things while doing it. So I thought I'd share what this episode was powered by. And I actually would like to share this week's episode is powered by segment. It's going to be a little bit different because I'd like to share some resources and things that I have learned from and listened to in preparation for this episode that I think you might find interesting to listen to for yourself. So for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, obviously there was that movie with Tom Hanks, which I think was called Won't You Be My Neighbor, but there's also a documentary called Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is very, very good. So you can find Won't You Be My Neighbor streaming now on Netflix. That is where it currently is. And it goes into the life and the philosophy of Fred Rogers and goes into a little bit of the show and the different stories behind the show. It's very, very good. A tearjerker, absolutely. And highly, highly, highly recommended. All of these come highly recommended for me, obviously, because I was listening to them. For Sesame Street, there are a ton of different resources and articles and research that is done. So for all of these shows, there is a book minus Bluey because it's a little bit too recent from when this book came out, but a lot of what I've learned about children's educational programming from the research side comes from this book called Children's Learning from Educational Television, Sesame Street and Beyond by Shalom M. Fish, about some of the research into just how kids think about television and how they watch it. But for Sesame Street, my biggest recommendation, if you're interested in learning a little bit more about the production behind it, is the documentary Street Gang, How We Got to Sesame Street, which is on HBO Max. It's a great documentary. I watched it a couple years ago at Sundance. It was very, very good. Highly recommend that. For Blue's Clues, the Nick Animation podcast episode featuring Angela Santomero and Tracy Page Johnson is great, and it just talks about a lot of what went into their concepting for the show, their backgrounds, the impact of the show, a lot of the things that we talked about within the episode, they elaborate on even more, and it's from the sources themselves. For the Backyardigans and for Bluey, since they're a little bit newer, I would say, I just recommend going back and watching those shows and watching Bluey, like just seeing kind of what the impact of those previous three works are on new works is always going to be great. Whether you have kids or not, just staying up to date on what children's programming looks like, because you never know how applicable that information might be able to be for you. So, like I mentioned at the top of the episode, we're going to be staying on this topic for the next 2 weeks. And next week, I'm actually going to be joined by a very, very special guest who knows a thing or two about the children's educational programming landscape. So that's going to be a very fun interview. I hope you guys are super excited for it. And I hope you tune in and let me know what you think. So I hope you enjoyed this week's chat and that you'll join me again next week for another pop culture deep dive. Later days, friends.
Hey, this is Eric Malinsky, host of the podcast Imaginary Worlds. Each episode, I explore different sci-fi fantasy genres, talking with filmmakers, novelists, game designers, cosplayers, comic book artists, and anyone who works in the field of make-believe. I also look at the fan experience, asking, why do we suspend our disbelief? You can subscribe to Imaginary Worlds wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, just checking in. And seeing if you might want to step away from the noise of the world for just a moment and connect back to you. If so, join me on my podcast, Letting It Settle with Michael Galyon, where we'll explore mindfulness, self-love, and personal growth as I share practical insights and tools to hopefully help inspire you to start to take charge of your mental and emotional well-being. Search for Letting It Settle with Michael Galyon on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening now.